It's a brand new season of the Politocrat Daily Podcast for conversation, information, and revelation. Join me, Omar Moore, every day for a brand new edition of the Politocrat Daily Podcast. Politics, news, issues you care about, guests, and commentary, all on the Politocrat Daily Podcast. So please join me for every new episode. Subscribe now. And thank you very much for your support.
In some circles, it's become a popular crusade against the war in Vietnam. I say we must enter that struggle, but I wish to go on now to say something even more disturbing. The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit. And if we ignore this sobering reality, we will find ourselves organizing clergy and layman concern committees for the next generation. They will be concerned about Guatemala and Peru. They will be concerned about Thailand and Cambodia. They will be concerned about Mozambique and South. We will be marching for these and a dozen other names and attending rallies without end, unless that is a significant and profound change in American life and policy.
Welcome to the Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore. It is Monday, January the 18th, 2021. On this edition of The Politocrat, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, his Beyond Vietnam speech, A Time to Break Silence, and Letter from Birmingham Jail. Both will feature in this episode on Dr. Martin Luther King Day here in the United States. That and more coming up next. Welcome back. Happy Martin Luther King Jr. Day to all of you listening to this episode, wherever you may be around the world. It's really great to have your ear on this Dr. Martin Luther King Day, or whenever it is you are listening to this episode. Thank you so much for doing so. Today is a very big day on the calendar, as it is every Monday in January, typically the third Monday of January. And this one is no different. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had his birthday this past Friday. And of course, on that day, I did an episode that spoke about and spoke to white America and why I think white America is in some very serious trouble, but just doesn't realize it yet. I do urge you on this Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day to listen back to that episode. I also urge you to watch on Netflix the documentary by Raoul Peck entitled I Am Not Your Negro. That documentary is still on Netflix. I strongly recommend, very strongly recommend, that you do indeed watch that documentary. It was released in 2016, was an Academy Award nominee in 2017 for Best Documentary Feature. James Baldwin was at the heart of that documentary. His unfinished manuscript, Remember This House, was the subject, but so many other things were as well. And I don't want to really go any further in terms of saying anything more about I am not your Negro. But I do urge you, if you have not seen it, to please do so today for sure. This day, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, the holiday, the national holiday, which took almost 30 years to get to, I assure you, is the perfect day to watch that documentary. Make sure you do, no matter what day you watch it on. It's on Netflix right now. Before getting into more of Dr. King and obviously what he stood for, I'm not going to go into the Dr. King speech that you all know, which is the so-called I Have a Dream speech that was given in 1963 on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, or rather the Washington Mall. That's not where I'm going first. In fact, I'm not going to go to that speech at all. But I do want to say something on this day about where we are here on this planet, specifically in the United States. And we are now 2 days away from the inauguration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. And I cannot say this strongly enough. The tension in the air could literally be cut with a knife. This is not a joyous inauguration. No matter how sprightly and positive and smiley-faced people within the Biden group are, I, for one, can honestly submit to you, dear listener, that I am extremely nervous about this inauguration. Oh yes, the champagne is ready. And someone like myself working from home is fortunate enough to be able to be in that position to open up some champagne, albeit early in the morning here on the West Coast. Kamala Harris will be sworn in at precisely noon, or just before noon, Eastern time. And right after that, Joe Biden will be sworn in. Now, it will be an historic swearing in for Kamala Harris. She will become the first female vice president of the United States. She will become the first black woman to be vice president of the United States. And she will become the first person of South Asian descent to be the vice president of the United States. Joe Biden will become the oldest person to have been sworn in as president of the United States, and he will become only the second Catholic to become president of the United States. I just want to let you know, I am nervous about this inauguration. Are you? Are you nervous? I mean, I am nervous. Because of what we saw with the terrorist attack nearly 2 weeks ago now on the U.S. Capitol, the very specter of both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris being sworn in on those very same steps makes me tremendously uneasy. How do you feel about that? Then an Associated Press story comes out on Sunday night, last night, saying that defense officials within the Pentagon are very concerned that there may be an insider attack by members of the National Guard during the inauguration. And what is being done about that is that the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the FBI, is going to be vetting and has started to vet each of the 25,000 armed National Guard. This is just extremely disconcerting. And given the person that we are honoring today in this country, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who didn't die of natural causes, of course, you know that very well, given that we are in an age where the terrorism in this country from white men is through the roof, and really that's the only kind of terrorism that we are facing, that we are endangered by right now. That is the only terrorism. And what's even more frightening, but not surprising, is that police are aiding it, and they are part of it. Military are part of it. And so the grave concern that some defense officials have, that there may be some kind of insider attack at the inauguration, that should be enough right there to say, nope, we're not going to have it here. We're going to have this at some kind of undisclosed location, pre-recorded, and then we're going to officially have a live speech somewhere. It's just too risky and too dangerous. It truly is. It's too risky and too dangerous. As I have been saying over the last few days, over the last few weeks, I am legitimately concerned about this inauguration. And if I were the Bidens and the Biden inaugural committee, and I said this last week here on this podcast, I would immediately move to another location, undisclosed, and a swearing in done at a time and a place that is not disclosed, and have it be a small group of people who are invited to the swearing in, the inauguration. It is incomprehensible to me that we have this kind of war zone where you've got 25,000 armed National Guard, and yet you still have someone with 500 or 5,000 rounds of ammunition able to get to a checkpoint. Now, how is that security? How is that supposed to be any measure of security? And now, on the eve of this inauguration, literally just 3 days away, you've got an Associated Press report that comes out saying that defense officials are very concerned that there could be an insider attack. I mean, this seems like this is tailor-made. I mean, this is something that is so obviously a red signal, a red alarm, a fire alarm, a five alarm fire, that you should really cancel this inauguration or simply move it to an undisclosed location. Why take a chance? Why take a chance? The inauguration does not have to officially happen, by the way, for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to take office. This is strictly a ceremonial thing. For those of you who think that the inauguration must take place in order for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris to take power, the answer to that is no, it is not required. It is purely ceremonial. And I guarantee you that if you had a choice between ensuring the absolute safety of both Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, and come on, I mean, risking it? I don't think there's really a, surely there's not an issue there. You would choose preserving their safety in a heartbeat. So I just am not clear on why this inauguration, now with this late breaking from last night, Associated Press story about defense officials concerned that there could be an inside attack amongst some of the National Guard at the inauguration. And now, at this late stage, the FBI is finally vetting these 25,000 armed individuals. Which begs the question, why weren't they vetted before? Especially with what happened nearly 2 weeks ago. It seems awfully hokey and really dangerous as far as I am concerned. It seems too lax, it seems just ill-advised, and it seems as if somebody wants some harm done to these two people and others. All of these death threats against politicians these past few days, these past few weeks and months, and it's been a staple of American history as well, just gives me pause. This is the last time I'm going to say this. I pray that everything is okay on Wednesday, and I pray that it is a safe inauguration, and I pray that the term of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, the 4 years, or maybe eight, depending on how long Joe Biden decides to stay in office, is safe, secure, healthy, and happy. And, of course, filled with successes for an agenda that is progressive and an agenda that treats everybody with justice and fairness. I am very concerned, and I just want to leave it like that. I will not mention this again until after the inauguration. I will be happy to be wrong. But my goodness me, my concerns right now are just through the roof. It's as if I really don't even want to watch the thing, honestly, because I actually fear some really horrible things about this inauguration. And I pray to God I am wrong. I want so badly to be wrong. This is the thing I want to be wrong about. And I will be praying these next couple of days. I'm not even especially religious, actually, at all. I mean, I'm a Christian, but I am not especially religious. I will get real religious and prayerful these next 48 to 72 hours. Because the price is too high. And God help us if something happens to either of those two individuals or anybody else. The country is fractured as it is. We do not need any more of this. What should be a happy, joyous, and exciting inauguration is instead one filled with tension and dread in the air. And that's not supposed to be the way a transfer of power is effected. Not one bit. Now there's a brand new webpage, especially for this podcast. The Politocrat Daily Podcast can now be found on thepolitocrat.com, a brand new page that centralizes all of the places that you can listen to this podcast, the major platforms, and many others at thepolitocrat.com. Lots of content that you can see there right now. And every single day. So subscribe now to the Politocrat Daily Podcast and make sure you visit thepolitocrat.com. Thank you. Welcome back. It is Dr. Martin Luther King Day today. Here in the United States, otherwise known as MLK Day. It is a national holiday. It's a holiday that, it did not become a national holiday from the very start. And I've talked a bit about this over the last couple of episodes. It's interesting, the last two or three episodes I have done of this podcast all tie in together, somewhat a trilogy of sorts, if you will. Aside from the episode that I did with Barbara Justison, who is a pollster and principal of her firm JMI in Vancouver, British Columbia. But the other three episodes, that was a very entertaining, really lovely, delightful conversation. Really enjoyed the insights of Barbara Justison, by the way, and just a lovely individual, and really wise to what she does. And I think really good pollster as well. It's those other three episodes that are forming this trilogy of a connection, whether it be the episode on Friday that I did regarding Dr. King and white America and where we are today in 2021, and why I think that white America really is in very serious trouble. It's in very bad shape. Then the episode yesterday with Dwight D. Eisenhower and the military-industrial complex, the 60-year anniversary of his 1961 farewell speech, and whether or not we've learned any lessons from the warnings that Eisenhower had been giving us. But obviously, you know what the answer to that is. I mean, look at the militarization right now outside, inside the U.S. Capitol building. I think that's pretty darn self-explanatory. And then this episode today on Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s holiday. And the whole thread here is the militarization. It's the militarization and the mentality of America and Americans, particularly white Americans, and guns and machinery and defense armaments. I mean, this is and defense weaponry. I mean, this is really problematic. And so Dr. King comes in here, and he comes in here with two, what I think are the two most important, or among the two most important things he either wrote or said. The first, and both of them came about in the month of April, by the way. I find that to be very interesting. Both of those things that I think are the most important things he either said or did, or said or wrote, came about in April. One of them in April of 1963, the other of them in April of 1967. I'm going to start with the one from April of 1963. It was April the 16th of that year, where Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote Letter from Birmingham Jail. And he had been literally put behind bars after an arrest. And so he wrote a letter while in his jail cell. It was a lengthy letter. I will link to it on this, on the line notes of this episode. But I do want to read an extract from the letter. And again, the letter is quite long, and I think it'll probably be 2-3 minutes of reading, maybe a little bit less, for this particular portion of Letter from Birmingham Jail. Here's the excerpt. I must make two honest confessions to you, my Christian and Jewish brothers. First, I must confess that over the last few years, I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I have almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in the stride toward freedom is not the white citizen's counselor or the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice, who constantly says, I agree with you in the goal you seek, but I can't agree with your methods of direct action, who paternalistically feels that he can set the timetable for another man's freedom, who lives by the myth of time, and who constantly advises the Negro to wait a little until a more convenient season. Shallow understanding, from people of goodwill is more frustrating than absolute misunderstanding from people of ill will. Lukewarm acceptance is much more bewildering than outright rejection. In your statement, you asserted that our actions, even though peaceful, must be condemned because they precipitate violence. But can this assertion be logically made? Isn't this like condemning the robbed man because his possession of money precipitated the evil act of robbery? Isn't this like condemning Socrates because his unswerving commitment to truth and his philosophical delvings precipitated the misguided popular mind to make him drink the hemlock? Isn't this like condemning Jesus because his unique God-consciousness and never-ceasing devotion to his will precipitated the evil act of crucifixion? We must come to see, as federal courts have consistently affirmed, that it is immoral to urge an individual to withdraw his efforts to gain his basic constitutional rights because the quest precipitates violence. Society must protect the robbed and punish the robber. I had also hoped that the white moderate would reject the myth of time. I received a letter this morning from a white brother in Texas, which said all Christians know that the colored people will receive equal rights eventually, but is it possible that you are in too great of a religious hurry? It has taken Christianity almost 2,000 years to accomplish what it has. The teachings of Christ take time to come to earth. All that is said here grows out of a tragic misconception of time. It is the strangely irrational notion that there is something in the very flow of time that will inevitably cure all ills. Actually, time is neutral. It can be used either destructively or constructively. I am coming to feel that the people of ill will had used time more, much more effectively than the people of goodwill. We will have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence of the good people. We must come to see that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and persistent work of men willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the forces of social stagnation. You spoke of our activities in Birmingham as extreme. At first, I was rather disappointed that the fellow clergyman would see my non-violent efforts as those of an extremist. I started thinking about the fact that I stand in the middle of two opposing forces in the Negro community. One is a force of complacency made up of Negroes who, as a result of long years of oppression, have been so completely drained of self-respect and a sense of somebodiness that they have adjusted to segregation. And, on the other hand, of a few Negroes in the middle class who, because of a degree of academic and economic security and because at points they profit by segregation, have unconsciously become insensitive to the problems of the masses. The other force is one of bitterness and hatred and comes perilously close to advocating violence. It is expressed in the various black nationalist groups that are springing up over the nation, the largest and best known being Elijah Muhammad's Muslim movement. This movement is nourished by the contemporary frustration over the continued existence of racial discrimination. It is made up of people who have lost faith in America, who have absolutely repudiated Christianity, and who have concluded that the white man is an incurable devil. I have tried to stand between these two forces, saying that we need not follow the do-nothingism of the complacent or the hatred and despair of the black nationalist. There is a more excellent way of love and nonviolent protest. I'm grateful to God that through the Negro Church, the dimension of nonviolence entered our struggle. If this philosophy had not emerged, I am convinced that by now, many of the streets of the South would be flowing with floods of blood. And I am further convinced that if our white brothers dismiss as rabble-rousers and outside agitators those of us who are working through the channels of nonviolent direct action and refuse to support our nonviolent efforts, millions of Negroes, out of frustration and despair, will seek solace and security in Black nationalist ideologies, a development that will lead inevitably to a frightening racial nightmare. Oppressed people cannot remain oppressed forever. The urge for freedom will eventually come. This is what has happened to the American Negro. Something within has reminded him of his birthright of freedom. Something without has reminded him that he can gain it. Consciously and unconsciously, he has been swept in by what the Germans called the Zeitgeist. And with his Black brothers of Africa and his yellow and brown brothers of Asia, South America, and the Caribbean, he is moving with a sense of cosmic urgency toward the promised land of racial justice. Recognizing this vital urge that has engulfed the Negro community, one should readily understand public demonstrations. The Negro has many pent-up resentments and latent frustrations. He has to get them out. So let him march sometime. Let him have his prayer pilgrimages to the city hall. Understand why he must have sit-ins and freedom rides. If his repressed emotions do not come out in these nonviolent ways, they will come out in ominous expressions of violence. This is not a threat. It is a fact of history. So I have not said to my people, get rid of your discontent. Get rid of your discontent. But I have tried to say that this normal and healthy discontent can be channeled through the creative outlet of nonviolent direct action. Now, this approach is being dismissed as extremist. I must admit that I was initially disappointed in being so categorized. That is a portion of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from Birmingham Jail, written April the 16th, 1963. We have action of our own to do during the Biden-Harris administration. It is time for us to put our agenda forward. And let's do that right now. Let's not waste a single second. Time waits for no one. And we've got to get moving. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and so many others showed us the way. Letter from Birmingham Jail is one of the most read things in the history of the world, literally. It is a manuscript that has been read so many times the world over. Again, I will be linking to this entire letter. That was just a small snippet. This entire letter will be linked to the podcast episode. When I come back, more from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on this MLK Day. Welcome back. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was such a towering figure. I think that people are aware of that. But he has often been taken out of context and used in very pernicious ways by the Republican Party. Politicians whom have no moral center at all. In fact, not only a moral center, They don't have a political will or the courage to do the right thing, because they don't do the right thing. They do the wrong thing. They would have spat in Dr. King's eye back in the day. In fact, some of them did. But this particular situation now is really grave. And I think that the reason I'm going to play you a lengthy excerpt of the speech Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence, is because I think that what Dr. King said on April the 4th, 1967, at the Riverside Baptist Church in Harlem, USA, still applies to this very day in 2021 and in years to come beyond, because it describes the condition. This speech that I'm about to play, at least a portion of it, about 25, 26 minutes of it, describes exactly the condition of America and what America is. If you had to decide or decipher or define what America is and who it is, what identity it takes on, this speech would be the speech that would be your answer, an honest answer to the chaos and disconcertion that we have in the United States now. And it didn't just start 4 years ago. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. here, really raising the stakes. He was being told, stay in your lane when he did this speech and after he did this speech. Thankfully, he did not listen. But the sad part is that it cost him, arguably, his life. Many pointed to this speech that you are about to hear a part of being the key factor in him being assassinated. Dr. King, as you will hear shortly, makes no bones whatsoever about his position when it comes to the terrorist attack on Vietnamese, really, the onslaught against the Vietnamese during the Vietnam War, and makes it very clear where he thinks the United States lies and which side they lie on in light of what has been going on in Vietnam. Here now, without any further ado, is Dr. Martin Luther King. Here's a portion of it. Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence.
And Nora remembers how our leaders refused to tell us the truth about the earlier North Vietnamese overtures for peace, how the president claimed that none existed when they had clearly been made. Ho Chi Minh has watched as America has spoken of peace and built up its forces. Now he has surely heard the increasing international rumors of American plans for an invasion of the North. He knows the bombing and shelling and mining we are doing a part of traditional pre-invasion strategy. Perhaps only his sense of humor and of irony can save him when he hears the most powerful nation of the world speaking of aggression as it drops thousands of bombs on a poor, weak nation more than 8,000 miles away from its shores. At this point, I should make it clear that while I have tried in these last few minutes to give a voice to the voiceless in Vietnam, to understand the arguments of those who are called enemy, I am as deeply concerned about our own troops there as anything else. For it occurs to me that what we are submitting them to in Vietnam is not simply the brutalizing process that goes on in any war where armies face each other and seek to destroy. We are adding cynicism to the process of death, for they must know after the short period there that none of the things we claim to be fighting for are really involved. Before long, they must know that their government has sent them into a struggle among Vietnamese, the more sophisticated surely realize that we are on the side of the wealthy and the secure while we create a hell for the poor. Somehow this madness must cease. We must stop now. I speak as a child of God and brother to the suffering poor of Vietnam. I speak for those whose land is being laid waste, whose homes are being destroyed, whose culture is being subverted. I speak of speak for the poor of America who are paying the double price of smashed hopes at home, death and corruption in Vietnam. I speak as a citizen of the world, for the world as it stands aghast at the path we have taken. I speak as one who loves America, to the leaders of our own nation. The great initiative in this war is ours. The initiative to stop it must be ours. This is a message of the great Buddhist leaders of Vietnam. Recently, one of them wrote these words, and I quote, "Each day the war goes on, the hatred increases in the heart of the Vietnamese, in the hearts of those of humanitarian instinct. The Americans are forcing even their friends into becoming their enemies. It is curious that the Americans, who calculate so carefully on the possibilities of military victory, do not realize that in the process they are incurring deep psychological and political defeat. The image of America will never again be the image of revolution, freedom, and democracy, but the image of violence and militarism," unquote. We continue, "There will be no doubt in my mind and in the mind of the world that we have no honorable intentions in Vietnam. We do not stop our war against the people of Vietnam immediately. The world would be left with no other alternative than to see this as some horrible, clumsy, and deadly game we have decided to play. The world now demands a maturity of America that we may not be able to achieve. It demands that we admit that we have been wrong from the beginning of our adventure in Vietnam, that we have been detrimental to the life of the Vietnamese people. The situation is one in which we must be ready to turn sharply from our present ways. In order to atone for our sins and errors in Vietnam, we should take the initiative in bringing a halt to this tragic war. I would like to suggest five concrete things that our government should do to begin the long and difficult process of extricating ourselves from this nightmarish conflict. Number one, end all bombing in North and South Vietnam. Number two, declare a unilateral ceasefire in the hope that such action will create the atmosphere for negotiation. Three, take immediate steps to prevent other battlegrounds in Southeast Asia by curtailing our military buildup in Thailand and our interference in Laos. Four, realistically accept the fact that the National Liberation Front has substantial support in South Vietnam and must thereby play a role in any meaningful negotiations and any future Vietnam government. Five, set a date that we will remove all foreign troops from Vietnam in accordance with the 1954 Geneva Agreement, part of our ongoing commitment might well express itself in an offer to grant asylum to any Vietnamese who fears for his life under the new regime, which included the Liberation Front. Then we must make what reparations we can for the damage we have done. We must provide the medical aid that is badly needed, making it available in this country if necessary. Meanwhile, we in the churches and synagogues have a continuing task while we urge our government to disengage itself from a disgraceful commitment. We must continue to raise our voices and our lives if our nation persists in its perverse ways in Vietnam. We must be prepared to match actions with words by seeking out every creative method of protest possible. As we counsel young men concerning military service, we must clarify for them our nation's role in Vietnam and challenge them with the alternative of conscientious objection. Pleased to say that this is a path now chosen by more than 70 students at my own alma mater, Morehouse College, and I recommend it to all who find the American course in Vietnam a dishonorable and unjust one. Moreover, I would encourage all ministers of draft age to give up their ministerial exemptions and seek status as conscientious objectors. These are the times for real choices and not false ones. We are at the moment when our lives must be placed on the line if our nation is to survive its own folly. Every man of humane convictions must decide on the protest that best suits his convictions. But we must all protest. Now that is something seductively tempting about stopping there and sending us all off on what in some circles has become a popular crusade against the war in Vietnam. I say we must enter that struggle. But I wish to go on now to say something even more disturbing. The war in Vietnam is but a symptom of a far deeper malady within the American spirit. And if we ignore this sobering reality, we will find ourselves organizing clergy and layman concern committees for the next generation. They will be concerned about Guatemala and Peru. They will be concerned about Thailand and Cambodia. They will be concerned about Mozambique and South Africa. We will be marching for these and a dozen other names and attending rallies without end, unless that is a significant and profound change in American life and policy. Such thoughts take us beyond Vietnam, but not beyond our calling as sons of the living God. In 1957, a sensitive American official overseas said that it seemed to him that our nation was on the wrong side of a world revolution. During the past 10 years, we have seen emerge a pattern of suppression, which has now justified the presence of U.S. military advisors in Venezuela. This need to maintain social stability for our investment accounts for the counter-revolutionary action of American forces in Guatemala. It tells why American helicopters are being used against guerrillas in Cambodia, and why American napalm and green beret forces have already been active against rebels in Peru. It is with such activity in mind that the words of the late John F. Kennedy come back to haunt us. 5 years ago, he said, "Those who make peaceful revolution impossible will make violent revolution inevitable." Increasingly, by choice or by accident, This is the role our nation has taken, the role of those who make peaceful revolution impossible by refusing to give up the privileges and the pleasures that come from the immense profits of overseas investments. I am convinced that if we are to get on the right side of the world revolution, we as a nation must undergo a radical revolution of values. We must rapidly begin the shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society, when machines and computers, profit motives and property rights are considered more important than people. The giant triplets of racism, extreme materialism, and militarism are incapable of being conquered. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. On the one hand, we are called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside. That will be only an initial act. One day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be transformed, so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on life's highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. Revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look across the seas and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out. No concern for the social betterment of the countries, and say this is not just. It will look at our alignment with the landed gentry of South America and say, this is not just. Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of...
I'll be right back with this continued portion of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech, Beyond Vietnam, delivered on April the 4th, 1967, at the Riverside Baptist Church. Today in the United States is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day, a national holiday. Welcome back. Continuing with this final excerpt, continuing on from where we left off, this portion of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s Beyond Vietnam speech, A Time to Break Silence, delivered on April the 4th, 1967, exactly 1 year before he would be assassinated on April the 4th, 1968. The speech you are hearing and will continue to hear in a few moments was delivered at the Riverside Baptist Church in Harlem, USA, New York City. Here are the final minutes of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s most important speech, the one that you normally do not hear at all about in the corporate news media, cable news or otherwise. Beyond Vietnam.
On the world order and say of war, this way of settling differences is not just. This business of burning human beings with napalm, filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of people's sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. And most powerful nation in the world can well lead the way in this revolution of values. That is nothing except a tragic death wish to prevent us from reordering our priorities so that the pursuit of peace will take precedence over the pursuit of war. There is nothing to keep us from molding a recalcitrant status quo with bruised hands until we have fashioned it into a brotherhood. This kind of positive revolution of values is our best defense against communism. War is not the answer. Communism will never be defeated by the use of atomic bombs and nuclear weapons. Let us not join those who shout war and through their misguided passions urge the United States to relinquish its participation in the United Nations. These are days which demand wise restraint and calm reasonableness. We must not engage in a negative anti-communism, but rather in a positive thrust for democracy. Realizing that our greatest defense against communism is to take offensive action in behalf of justice. We must, with positive action, seek to remove those conditions of poverty, insecurity, and injustice, which are the fertile soil in which the seed of communism grows and develops. These are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. Out of the wombs of a frail world, new systems of justice and equality are being born. Shirtless and barefoot people of the land are rising up as never before. People who sat in darkness have seen a great light. We in the West must support these revolutions. It is a sad fact that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, and our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. This has driven many to feel that only Marxism has a revolutionary spirit. Therefore, communism is a judgment against our failure to make democracy real and follow through on the revolutions that we initiated. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal hostility to poverty, racism, and militarism. This powerful commitment, we shall boldly challenge the status quo and unjust mores, thereby speak the day when every valley shall be exalted and every mountain and hill shall be made low.
Yes.
Crooked shall be made straight and the rough places plain. Genuine revolution of values means in the final analysis that our loyalties must become ecumenical rather than sectional. Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. This call for worldwide fellowship that lifts neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation is in reality a call for an all-embracing and unconditional love for all mankind. This oft misinterpreted concept, so readily dismissed by the Nietzsches of the world as a weak and cowardly, has now become an absolute necessity for the survival of man. When I speak of love, I'm not speaking of some sentimental and weak response. I'm not speaking of that force which is just emotional bosh. I'm speaking of that force which all of the great religions have seen as the supreme unifying principle of life. Love is somehow the key that unlocks the door which leads to ultimate reality. This Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist belief about ultimate reality is beautifully summed up in the first epistle of St. John. Let us love one another.
Yes.
For love is God.
Yes.
And everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. If we love one another, God dwelleth in us, and his love is perfected in us. Let us hope that this spirit will become the order of the day. We can no longer afford to worship the God of hate, or bow before the altar of retaliation. The oceans of history are made turbulent by the ever-rising tides of hate. History is cluttered with the records of nations and individuals that pursued this self-defeating path of hate. As Arnold Toynbee says, love is the ultimate force that makes for the saving choice of life and good against the damning choice of death and evil. Therefore, the first hope in our inventory must be the hope that love is going to have the last word, unquote. We are now faced with the fact, my friends, that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, that is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing bare, naked, and dejected with a lost opportunity. The tide in the affairs of men does not remain at flood, it ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is adamant to every plea and rushes on. Over the bleached bones and jumbled residues of numerous civilizations, written the pathetic words, too late. That is an invisible book of life that faithfully records our vigilance or our neglect. Omar Khayyam is right to move and finger rights and having writ moves on. We still have a choice today. Nonviolent coexistence, a violent co-annihilation. We must move past indecision to action. We must find new ways to speak for peace in Vietnam and justice throughout the developing world, a world that borders on our doors. We do not act. We shall surely be dragged down the long, dark, and shameful corridors of time, reserved for those who possess power without compassion, might without morality, and strength without sight. Now let us begin. Now let us rededicate ourselves to the long and bitter but beautiful struggle for a new world. This is the calling of the sons of God, and our brothers wait eagerly for our response. Shall we say the odds are too great? Shall we tell them the struggle is too hard? Will our message be that the forces of American life militate against their arrival as full men, and we send our deepest regrets? Will there be another message of longing, of hope, of solidarity with their yearnings, of commitment to their cause, whatever the cost? The choice is ours. And though we might prefer it otherwise, we must choose in this crucial moment of human history. As that noble bard of yesterday, James Russell Lowell, eloquently stated, once to every man and nation comes a moment to decide in the strife of truth and falsehood for the good or evil side. Some great cause, God's new Messiah, offering each the gloom of light, and the choice goes by forever twixt that darkness. Though the cause of evil prosper, yet 'tis true. though her portion be the scaffold, and upon the throne be wrong, yet that scaffold sways the future. Behind the dim unknown standeth God within the shadow, keeping watch above his own. And if we will only make the right choice, we will be able to transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of peace. We will make the right choice. We will be able to transform the jangling discords of our world into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. We will but make the right choice. We will be able to speed up the day all over America and all over the world when justice will roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
That was part of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech from April the 4th, 1967. Beyond Vietnam, a time to break silence. The speech was given exactly 1 year before Dr. King would be assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee. Dr. King's words, very important in that speech, as they always were, but particularly in Beyond Vietnam, a speech that doesn't ever really get played on the 24-hour cable news networks, but it really should. I was playing you just a portion of that speech, the last roughly half hour of it, with a break in between. Such an important speech, that one, because it really does lay out just how the American system is, the inherent problems, to say the least, evils of the American system. And the American condition and mindset. I think these are the kinds of words that you should be listening to over the next few days. In fact, over the next 48 hours. America must change its ways. It is that simple. It really is that simple. Change or perish. Enjoy your Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Thank you very much for listening to this edition of The Politocrat. I'm Omar Moore.